Hi, I'm John Atack, and I'm very pleased to welcome Joe Kelly to the show.
Thank you for having me, John. Do you know anything about my background? How I got involved in the exit counseling or cult intervention field?
Only the brief thumbnail that Pat's just given me, actually.
So I was involved in transcendental meditation for 9 years. And while there, I became a levitator. You've heard about the miracles of levitation that Maharishi Mahesh Yogi taught us.
Oh.
But the initial, you know, impulse for me to start meditating was, of course, the Beatles. I was walking down the avenue in my neighborhood. Excuse me, I was between my first and second year of college. I saw this kind of psychedelic poster with a picture of Maharishi in the middle. And I thought, that's what I've been looking for. It was that impulse, that kind of thing. And then I was going to the library to study for exams and do some research. And on the shelf of the top 10 books for that week was Transcendental Meditation by a guy named Jack Forum. So it was all starting to unfold. I thought, okay, I just saw the poster down the street. His book is on the shelf. The buzz of knowing that the Beatles were involved and had traveled to India. And it was still rather vague for me because I was raised as a Catholic kid, had done a fair bit of experimenting with substances, which would be marijuana, a little bit of mescaline and some LSD. So I had already had an understanding that there was something beyond our normal consciousness and began reading about alternative consciousness. And coming from the Catholic background, the idea of mystics and saints was not something that was far removed from my reality. So here was this guy who was a contemporary hero, if you will. He was somebody who had gotten a lot of press. I didn't know the bit about him being known as Sexy Sadie, which the song about him was written about. And I saw him as a possible, you know, progenitor of the ideas of peace and love that I had been exposed to as a young person. I mean, and by that, I mean, when I was in eighth grade, it was 1969. So we're talking about 12, 13 years old. And I remember the ideas started to filter through my mind about, let's go to California, love and peace, be a part of the hippie generation. And I came from a fairly conservative Catholic background. So I thought, well, this would be an opportunity. And the thing also that appealed to me about TM was the notion that it was scientifically validated. Mm-hmm. That in the back of Jack Forum's book on TM, they had studies which pointed to the fact that grades improved, pragmatic benefit. Your blood pressure would go down. You could get rid of acne, all of which concerned me at the age of 17. So these were all things that I thought, wow, so I can achieve world peace, because there was this concept that if 10% of us meditated in a community, we could stop wars. And I had been a part of the early marches against the bombing of Cambodia and saw Jane Fonda when she came to visit Philadelphia in 1972 or 73. So all of this was a part of my consciousness at the moment. And so I went to found out where the local center is, called them up, found out that it was in Center City, Philadelphia. I lived in the north part of the city. I took a subway to the lecture, and there I met, you know, it was kind of surprising in that I expected them all to be like laid back hippies with, you know, kind of leather, you know, fringed vests and long hair and, you know, peace and all that. And instead, what I encountered were these like young businessmen. You know, they all had suits and ties. The women all had stylish dresses, but all very business-like attire. And that kind of surprised me, but it wasn't off-putting. And when I sat and listened to the lecture, they were so cheery and upbeat and talking about creating this new age. And that appealed to me. That really struck me as something worthwhile. So I took the first course. While there, I met this charming young woman who was they called them initiators or teachers. She was 19, and I was 18. And she was cute and kind of, she was a Quaker, and the values of peace and love seemed to be, you know, a part of her reality. And then I went through the 3 days of instruction, and within a week or two, they asked me to come and volunteer at the center, at the TM center. And I was like, you know, I was a pretty shy kid at that point, and I didn't, you know, want to be sitting at a front desk anywhere, let alone at a TM center, you know. But I did it because I thought I was going to add to the world's peace and love and whatnot. So as a result of that, I began to get close to the people at the TM center. And they encouraged me to do more courses, to meditate more, to become a TM checker, which meant that I was, as a 19-year-old kid, involved in checking the meditations of lawyers and businessmen, doctors and judges who were coming through the TM center at that time, because it was all the rage. It had become, from 1974 to 75, there had been a program where one of the big talk show hosts, his name was Merv Griffin, had introduced Maharishi to the American public and the world and talked about the benefits of TM in a pragmatic way for the average individual, you know, in the workplace. And so it exploded. It was just enough alternative that people wanted to try something new. There was a certain openness to alternative ideas. And there seemed to be no end to the new flow of people coming through the center. So I was exposed to people from a whole range of backgrounds in that setting. And I thought it was really exciting because, you know, I came from this, you know, very parochial background. And it was almost like my neighborhood was a little village of Irish Catholic dumb, you know. I didn't know a Jewish person, even though adjacent to the neighborhood I grew up, maybe we're talking six blocks away, was a large, significant Jewish community with Orthodox Jews and their yeshivas who would go to temple on the weekends. I mean, they kind of passed through my peripheral awareness, but I didn't know anyone. So at the TM Center, I got to meet people who were from a Jewish background, from a Quaker background, who were atheists and were business people. And I was becoming an instructor to them. You know, this kid who really knew nothing other than what I was trained to do in a rote way by the TM organization. And so by the increase of meditation, the ideas of Maharishi that there was an ability to raise one's consciousness. And I should say that in that first meditative moment, the chatter that had been going on in my brain, the ideas that, you know, of anxiety, they had kind of fallen away. And I thought, there's something unique here. If it was only for a few moments, it was relief. Mm-hmm. It was relief from the worries of being, you know, post-adolescent, of, you know, the turmoil that was going on in my life, the idea that I wanted to make a difference in the world, but had no idea what to do. I didn't know where to begin. And Maharishi's message indicated that I could be changing the world and improving myself. Yeah. So the individual improves and the world improves. So both of these things were happening, you were able to achieve them simultaneously. It was all very exciting. So we got involved, and as time progressed, my social network became exclusively transcendental meditators. The ideas of the movement that weren't ever expressed publicly, but were private, were expressed to me at the center. So we would meet teachers who had just been with Maharishi in either Switzerland or some other exotic locale, maybe Asia. They'd gone to visit him. They'd spent time with him. I only knew him from the TV screen and the videotapes that we were able to see him on. And so I took all the courses that were available. I was fed a doctrine of peace and love through this technique. And the idea was that nothing more needed to be done. That the TM technique had everything within its sphere to change a human being from a unenlightened, ignorant individual to an enlightened supreme being. So not only were there God men, this was a lot to take on, but you could become one, that you yourself could become a Maharishi. And that would mean that all of the cares, all the stress would fall away. And you would be able to achieve higher states of consciousness. And it was all abstract to me. I didn't know what that meant. I knew that my little meditation was something that seemed to relax me. I changed my major. I was a geography major at the time. I thought I wanted to learn more about ecology and become an ecological scientist or something like that at the time. And that major was just beginning to be explored at Temple University, where I went to school. So I was taking all the preliminary courses to be able to take that course. And then I was invited to a exclusive group of people that were going to study the sort of Bible of the Hindu faith called the Bhagavad Gita, as taught by Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. And it was in those Sunday meetings in the suburbs at an exclusive girls' school in the suburbs that I began to really imbibe the doctrine and understand what it was that Maharishi was really teaching us. And it was the idea that by transcending, by going beyond this world, you would be able to carry that consciousness with you as a full-time reality. And it would be something that would never leave you, and that Maharishi had achieved that goal. So as a perfect being, his utterances and everything he said was shifting from being, you know, just a knowledgeable professor and a highly intelligent individual to God himself. So had moved, you know, incrementally from something that was a relaxation technique to something that was going to bring about a unique state of consciousness that could only be achieved on this path. And I began at the same time to read everything I could get my hands on about Hinduism, about gurus, about the challenge of the path, about what an aspirant does while on the path, about staying one-pointed on your program, that you were walking a razor's edge, as Somerset Maugham said in the book, you know, The Razor's Edge. And all of that was very appealing to me. It was, I can really make a difference. And the cool part about it was I didn't have to go to the third world countries and get my hands dirty. I could sit in silence and achieve perfect bliss and be a radiator, like a battery, to the rest of the world. It was a convenient, you know, out for somebody who wanted to achieve something more and do something more in the world. So it was a really exciting time. And the numbers of people coming into the center were substantial. And that lasted for about 2 to 3 years. And then things started to become rather ordinary. And the Maharishi began to introduce something even more potent. And that was the idea of learning supernormal power, that we could, through his organization, achieve something that no one else could achieve. And he was the only one who was able to share this with us. Such a gift from the master. And I began to then know him as a master. I began to take longer courses of meditation. The associations with old friends had fallen away. I had stopped smoking pot. I had become a vegetarian. I had sort of moved into houses living in groups of other meditators. So it was all changing. It was all, and I was, you know, seeing myself as instrumental in the change. And my goals were to become a TM teacher. In order to do that, though, I first had to take the course in Siddhis. It was an amazing time that there was the movement had gone from instituting meditation in elementary and high schools, and there was a huge lawsuit. And in 1975, TM was kicked out of public schools in the U.S., and it was a landmark suit. And I remember thinking that the Maharishi would be very even about it, since that's what he was proclaiming. And he was PO'd. He was upset, and it shook me. For the first time, I began to see the beginning of the warts, chinks in his armor. And it was startling. So he did a public talk. And it was recorded and then sent to all the centers. And he started to talk about the fact that he single-handedly had taken the dirty hippie culture and transformed it into something clean and good and pure. And this is the gratitude he gets from the Americans. And I thought, whoa, that's like a little bit of megalomania there. So, and I thought that. But of course, I stuffed it. And you know what people would say when the leader showed any kind of counterposition to what the doctrine says, cognitive dissonance causes us to double down. And as a result of that, I became more devoted to the movement. So we began to levitate together. I was the first in my small group to actually hop. And I was kind of a quiet kid who would sit in the background and, you know, not say too much. And, you know, I was doing my meditation and didn't want a lot of fuss in my environment. And when I was first in my group to hop, suddenly I became a minor celebrity. So yeah, I went from, you know, being ordinary Joe to being semi-enlightened Joe. So I saw that as kind of that also kind of pointed something out to me, that all of these people that had come back from Switzerland being with the Maharishi and had these extraordinary mystical experiences were nasty people. I mean, not all of them, but many of them. So you're supposed to become more enlightened. You're supposed to become a better human being. And what's going on here? There's something really wrong with this picture. So I began to start having doubt. And at that time, I met some other meditators who were a little bit more, they were more mavericks. They were more outside of the tight controls of the movement. And I started to work for them. There was a business where we were encouraged to work with other meditators in business. And there was a business that sold and grew alfalfa and mung bean sprouts, which were very popular at that time. And they were big in salad bars and, you know, things like that. And so these meditators started this business and I started working for them. And the opportunity to work with a meditator-owned business was considered to be an opportunity unto itself, when in reality it was a horrible place to work. The people, because they were meditators, were supposed to have an innate ability to manage, and they were really horrible managers. They were not good at all. And And so while working for that business, we decided to move into this one area of Philadelphia. They had bought a house here. It was kind of a really rough dead end street in the heart of South Philadelphia. And there was a guy that my friend was inviting to become a part of this community. And his name was Pat Ryan. And he was invited from Myrish International to come and join us in this community.
So with Pat, we started to buy houses on this little street in South Philadelphia. And there I was introduced to one of the invitees on this in this little community was a man named Swami Prakashanand Saraswati. And he was the real deal, I thought. He was in orange. He had a beard and long hair. But not only that, he seemed to vibrate a certain feeling that I hadn't felt up to that point. So when the Swami enters the picture on Clarion Street in South Philadelphia, everything changes. The meditators who had bought houses and started fixing them up were divided into two categories. Those that were a part of this interest in Swami and those who weren't. Right. Yes, and so I was part of the group that went to visit the Swami, and I really held out for a good 2 months. And then he moved in next door to me. And it was at that time that he knocked on my door and actually invited me to come to the meeting, which was called Satsang. And I went into this little living room area, and he was sitting in the chair and I was sitting on the floor, and he began to chant. And I was really enveloped in this feeling of peace and love and all the things that I was supposed to be experiencing, having at this point devoted 8.5 years to transcendental meditation. And yet within one meeting, I was beginning to experience something with this guy that I hadn't experienced elsewhere. And what resonated with me was the idea that when the disciple is ready, the guru comes. So I felt that I had primed myself through this meditation technique and was now ready for a new message. And within Hinduism, there's many different flavors of belief. There's, you know, the abstract Brahman, who is it's like that which underlies all of creation, energizes it. And the hope is that through yoga and asceticism or meditation, one can tap into that storehouse of all consciousness and elevate your own. This guru taught that the ultimate reality was a personality, and that personality was Krishna. And not only Krishna, but Krishna's consort, Radha, was the ultimate secret, that the two of them together created the stuff of divine love. And that by devoting oneself through service to the teacher who had come to you, you would then be able to experience that same reality in everyday life. And that the world was not something to be invested in, that it was a waste of time, that relationships were a waste of time. There was only one relationship that one had to be concerned with. And that was God's love through Radha Krishna and on this earth, the guru. And so hearing this message and being set up for the possibility of experiencing guru's love, I decided to join with Swamiji.
And how long have you been How long had you been involved with TM for by this time?
9 years.
9 years.
And toward the end of my book, and pardon me, go ahead.
Am I right in thinking this would be a form of bhakti yoga, devotional?
That's right. It was called, it was a form of bhakti that was emphasizing Krishna's love with Radha, which was, you know, the lila, a principle of play between God and his image, and that she was even higher than Krishna, that Radha. So we were really Radha worshipers. And that idea of the secret, and it was a very small group in the beginning. Most of us were comprised of former TMers, and it became this huge battle between the TM organization and us, because what Swamiji was talking about was that he knew the Maharishi way back when, and that what Maharishi was teaching went against spiritual growth. So not only were we, you know, not achieving, moving quickly toward a state of enlightenment, but we were actually backtracking and going into the darkness. So this concept of what's more important, the radiation of the bulb or the bulb itself, that was the image, that was the metaphor, that the analogy that was used to describe what we were worshiping in TM. It was just the radiance of the bulb, but it was really the bulb itself that was Krishna, and his radiance was this Brahman state, whereas the TM path taught that the Brahman state was a higher state, the preferred state, and that the gods were lesser. They were manifestations of this higher state of consciousness. And so understanding this meant that we were now, you know, part of the secret society that we had been brought in. And at the time I met the Swami, there were only 100 members, or maybe 150 around the world. And here I was sitting with him alone in a room being given personal instruction about my life, about my business, about each step I was taking in a way that I imagined a guru would direct a disciple. You know, when you read stories of those special opportunities that would arise in your life, this guy was the one. And so during this time, we, as we learned more of his philosophy and became more at odds with our TM friends, they all fell away. We established an ashram in Philadelphia here, a center in another part of the city. It was an old mansion with an Olympic-sized swimming pool in a neighborhood that was down on its luck, yet this gem within the neighborhood was something that was able to be bought for him very inexpensively. And at this time, I was in business with two partners, one of whom was involved with the Swami and one whom wasn't. The one who wasn't was Pat Ryan. So Pat was standing on the outside of this. He had visited with the Swami. He had been invited to attend satsang, as it was called. And, you know, we were good friends at this point. We were like brothers, all of us. We shared a house. We you know, ate together. We practiced meditation together up to the point of the Swami. And the Swami felt that Pat, as a director, as a financial director of this new business, this fledgling business that was fueling at that time some of our ability to take TM courses, could now be a help and aid to him to fuel his business, his enterprise, his growth. And so my other friend, who was a devotee, and myself, who became one, were encouraged to take a look at how to gain more money. And one of my friends, who was a part of, who had been a TMer, and we had all done meditation and levitation, supernormal powers, suggested that getting our money back from the TM organization would be a beginning. That, and it would be a way to put the movement on notice that their false doctrine was not going to be taken lightly. That being able to, you know, con people by teaching them supernormal powers like circus tricks was not something that would bring you any closer to God or achieving enlightenment. So we all decided to ask the TM movement for our money back, and they more or less laughed at us. They thought, sure, if you think you have cause, sue us. And so at that time, we started to approach legal help, and everybody was looking at us like, I'm staying far away from this. This is not something I want to get anywhere near. And then we found an attorney who had been involved in litigation against EST, or the Erhard Seminars program. And he had had some success in litigation. And he was like very willing to take us on as a contingency, because he thought that, of course, nobody learns to levitate within the TM organization, and yet they're selling it as authentic and real. And so it was at that time that we began to explore how to, you know, what does one go about in order to sue a multi-million dollar organization? So here we were, you know, seven guys with virtually no money, with an attorney who was kind of, you know, curious and willing, took us on. And there were, at that time, I believe there were eight or nine of us. And there were a solid block of maybe six of us that were involved with the Swami. Mm-hmm. And then there were maybe three or four, five others who weren't involved with the Swami. And so we wanted to make it that way so that it wouldn't appear that it was a guru war. It was a battle between factions. And so during this time, the attorney said, look, you guys, you know, you're going to have to express to a jury of your peers how it is that you believed that, you know, being college educated, that somehow that you were going to be able to levitate, and when you weren't able to levitate, you were complaining about it. You know, how are you going to explain that to a jury of your peers that they'll have any sympathy for you whatsoever? And so it was that began to fuel the idea that we had to come up with a way, with a method for understanding our experience. And he had a storehouse of experts at that time whom he had worked with. And these individuals had experience in educating others about the nature of cults. And while we were willing to label the TM organization a cult, and even willing to look at ourselves as a cult, we considered the International Society of Divine Love, as Swamiji's group was known, as a benign cult, or as the real thing, the authentic path to God. And that TM being, you know, directing people in a sort of Hindu televangelist way to, you know, kind of the glitz and glamour of a path that was being taken on by Hollywood stars and, you know, achieving these experiences that were false. This path of God realization was something that was true and honest and pure. So Jerry Ragland, the attorney, said, you know, what I want you guys to do, since I can't afford to do the research, hire researchers to do the background research on the in the litigation, you all are going to have to be the researchers. And so on a schedule, me and my fellow members, devotees of the International Society of Divine Love, were going down to Washington, D.C., to Jerry Ragland's house, and spending weekends there reviewing TM materials, finding experts in the field of meditation who challenged the Maharishi's conception that only good can come from the path. that we began to learn of suicides within the TAM organization, people having emotional breakdowns on advanced courses. I myself was a witness of attempted violence at a peaceful retreat where one guy during one of the meditation sessions had picked up a chair and was going to break it over another participant's head, none of which fit with the image of an organization that could only bring about peace. Mm-hmm. And it was at that time that Jerry advised us that there was this organization called the Cold Awareness Network. And it was a grassroots organization of loved ones and ex-members who were willing to talk about their experience in groups. And it was that invitation that I presented to the Swami. And I said, you know, the attorney wants us to attend these Cold Awareness Network conferences. What do you think? He said, well, if it's going to win the case, then go. And I was kind of surprised at that he was actually encouraging us to attend. Simultaneously, we were advised to meet with some of the experts in the field, Dr. Jolly West, Dr. Margaret Singer, and Richard Offshee, a sociologist, a psychologist maybe. And they were going to interview us. And so Richard Offshee came and visited Philadelphia. We were interviewed by him. And he's the first one that raised the idea that maybe one needed to look at not only the TM organization, but the group you were involved in. And that scared the hell out of me. I thought, what have I gotten myself into? The conflict was huge. I was going to be deposed by the TM movement, by high profile lawyers in a closed setting with no guru present. And I was going to have to come up with my own personal reasons as to why I would litigate against the TAM organization. And so I was sitting in California. The appointment had been made with Margaret Singer, and she began to talk gently, easily over tea and toast at her kitchen table in Berkeley.
That's Margaret.
Margaret. You met Margaret.
Margaret Fortune, yeah.
Yeah.
In the same place in Berkeley where you had.
Berkeley, over her kitchen table or in her living room in the Berkeley Hills. And she started to talk about my experience and started to encourage me to, in a gentle way, but in an informative way, what the nature of influence looks like, that there is these disguised techniques of hypnosis, that there's other ways of looking at these extraordinary experiences that you're basing your commitment on, that the values that had been shared with you were, you know, serving the guru and the teacher and weren't serving me. But that was all done through analogy. It was done by parable, by suggestion, by not coming right out and saying, hey, you're in big trouble, boy. You know, you'd better look at where you find yourself and, you know, review the fact that you're being encouraged to litigate against Guru One by an equally, you know, diabolical character as Guru Number Two, without saying any of that.
Yep.
So she interviewed me and I told my story to her about, you know, the meditation, that what I began to experience, that I was becoming, you know, depressed as a result of the practices. I wasn't becoming any more happy or enlightened, that the TM organization was encouraging me to get deeper and to spend more money in learning their practices, and that I was seeing people around me really becoming psychotic and not any better. So how did I jive these two? Well, the guru was now going to present me with a clear picture of what true enlightenment would offer. And Margaret Singer was able to, you know, kind of take me out of this whole worldview and was able to make me look at it anew, you know, and talked about, you know, the different, what undue influence is, you know, what disguise techniques of hypnosis are, and the TM organization and ISDL were both incorporating these techniques within their repertoire. So she said, so Joe, I just want to leave you with this one question as you leave. What makes you think that the Swami is all that different from the Maharishi? And it's not something that, you know, you need to worry about too much, but I'm just asking you the question, and kind of left me with that and sent me back to the ashram. She didn't send me, I went. But she was now finished evaluating me and was going to write up her evaluation for the court for the TM lawsuits. So the TM attorneys began to depose us, and the depositions were grueling. Yeah. They were long. Yeah. They were unrelenting. They put emotional pressure on us, and we were not really prepared for that. One of my friends who almost had a nervous breakdown during deposition, and the attorney had to appeal to the court. And after him, all depositions were then before a magistrate, and he was going to supervise the deposition so that the ATM attorneys didn't become too hard hitting. Yeah. And so I was the next deposition after my friend Pat Lynch, who had really lost it. And I knew why Pat Lynch was losing it. It was because he didn't want to feel like he was revealing what was really going on in the background, challenging TM, and also knowing what he was being asked to do by Swami Prakashanand or Swami G. So there was this undercurrent of intrigue that no one knew about other than this group of us who were involved with the Swami. And so when Pat Lynch had more or less broken down and needed to be observed by a psychiatrist because he had become so anxious and frightened and shaking, and it was, you know, I thought, I'm next. I'm next. I'm going to be put in front of the firing squad. And, you know, the worry was that we would somehow reveal something that would incriminate the Swami in litigation against the Maharishi. So we were between a rock and a hard place. And some of the members of the group could flow very easily back and forth. And then there were those that were less experienced in lying. They weren't quite adept at being easy liars. And they, therefore their value was minimized by the group. The people who could, you know, kind of sit there and almost sociopathically keep a straight face without revealing what the truth was behind the scenes were the ones that were elevated in this organization, in ISDL. They became leaders.
Yeah.
And I was, you know, simultaneously taking this in, litigating against TM, meeting with Margaret Singer, attending Cold Awareness Network organization workshops and sitting in groups of ex-members, listening to their stories of involvement in various unsavory and duplicitous organizations. Some were large group awareness trainings, some were new age groups, some were small churches. My image when I went to my first Cold Awareness Network conference was I'd be able to handle them. They were all fundamentalist Christians. And, you know, therefore I, you know, there would be nothing there that I could learn. I was a good, strong, committed Hindu. And that by virtue of my real Hinduism, I would be able to fend off these arguments about Jesus being the only Lord and Savior. And when I got there, there were people from all different backgrounds and they weren't committed to one ideology or one faith. So that kind of struck me that it really shook me to my core. Yeah. I was hearing people give their story, talk about their experiences, about a leader who promised them some high state of consciousness, some unique relationship with God, some purity in their life. And these were all things that were being offered to me. And so in listening to them and in talking to experts like Margaret, and researching on the weekends, the, you know, what meditation can do to one, that it's not necessarily all sunshine and, you know, daffodils. It's not you know, pure joy and God's love, that there were individuals who were stepping into these realms and having serious problems. And when I reflected on those individuals in the organization who weren't achieving spiritual heights or weren't easily going into the encouraged experiences, they were considered less than, and they were considered, you know, not somebody to be emulated. The ones to be emulated were those who could easily achieve these high states of consciousness. And how did I explain that? How did I explain that? And by understanding what hypnosis does, what influence does, how creating a group environment, you know, all of these items could affect the way we perceive our very reality. We could then experience something that would be new and different from our normal state of consciousness. The studies and the other members' experiences were something that, you know, was something that could be achieved by anyone. So it wasn't just, you know, the guru's love. It wasn't just his eminence. It wasn't just being obedient to the path. There was something more at work here. And so it took about a year and a half of being involved with the Swami. I was involved for 5 years with his group. And I began to see, you know, him promoting the same kinds of behaviors that had been promoted in the TM organization. That he wasn't always kind. That more of his true persona was being revealed. And simultaneously, we were learning about his guru. And that was significant because his guru was more or less a crazy adept, if you know this concept.
I do.
A mad guru who shatters your reality and does it by doing things that might be considered underhanded. Have no worldly value or be downright abusive.
Yeah.
And word had been slipping back from India that women who were going to visit him were being sexually attacked at the ashram in India. So the first experiment of, and I should say here, it gets rather convoluted.
Okay.
There were preachers sent out by Kripalu Mahaprabhuji to teach this doctrine of Radha Krishna love. Love. And Swamiji was one of those preachers. And along the way, when he was first traveling in New Zealand, Fiji, and Australia, he had been kicked out of Australia for some reason. He had been told not to come back. And it was rumored that his own guru had accused him of being a carpet thief, that he was selling stolen carpets.
Okay.
And as crazy as this all sounds, this is what was being reported to us, and we didn't know what to make of it. But by then, I was so invested in the group and the experience. And I should say that when I first met him, I couldn't explain some of the experiences I had. The first experience that I found to be inexplicable was this feeling of being peaceful 24 hours a day, and it lasted for a week. It was 1 week of this extraordinary experience, and I thought, okay, this is what enlightenment is. I finally achieved it. And soon after that, in a chanting environment, we were sitting there, it was twilight, we were all chanting, and I was having this kind of internal vision, and I opened my eyes, and there was a guru glowing in golden light, sitting with eyes open in front of me. So no matter what kind of evil I knew was out there, I thought that there must be some way to explain it. And then when I learned this concept of you can't evaluate a man's consciousness by his behavior. So your subjective reality is the only way of measure. The only source is that which comes from within.
Yep.
So these powerful internal experiences, coupled with the knowledge that he was going to shake me out of even my ethical value, my morals, they were all, in a way, material goods. They were all subtle material. And you had to do away with all of that because it was worldly to know God, who is so otherworldly that any standard that we have of measure cannot be considered a value. So that now there was a twosome. There was the guru in India. There was the Swami, who went about taking the book that he wrote and encouraged us to all to rip out his picture in over 1,000 volumes. So his guru's picture had to be destroyed, and all knowledge of him had to be destroyed.
What George Orwell called the memory hole.
Exactly. Exactly, good phrase. That was exactly what we were encouraged to do. Wipe the memory clean and start anew with the Swami's perspective on the same path. So I'm, you know, at the same time in litigation, I attended not one but two Cold Awareness Network conferences. I'm beginning to have to juggle all of these disparate points of view, and my business failed. My business that I had built was was going into the tank. You know, it was really going in a bad way. And so I had to figure out, and then the guru wanted me to leave my home in another part of Philadelphia and move full time into the ashram. So I was learning more about the background of these guys. I was encouraged to become more deeply committed, and I had no, you know, viable means of support. And it was for sure they weren't going to support me, because your only value to the organization was that which you could bring to it. Finances, talent, energy, something of value. And I, at this point, had very little. So my world began to be shaken. I had the litigation against TM was going on. I was learning about the guru's guru. Members of the organization were going to India and coming back shattered. They were going to the homeland, more or less. And instead of coming back better, one woman had a complete and utter nervous breakdown. They were all women. One woman would come down to the prayer room in the morning and shake. Another woman, her mother was dying, and she said, she was told that not to focus at all on that. And she was so at odds with the desire to go back and what she was told to do by the Swami. So her mother was left to die on her own in New Zealand. And she said, I remember sitting there almost robotic saying, Swamiji told me that this is what I must do. And it was almost like the Manchurian candidate. I was still involved with the Swami at this time. And yet it had become so unbearable. He had, you know, laid down the gauntlet, told me that I had to commit more deeply. And yet I had this new body of information now. I understood what psychological abuse looks like. I had seen it and heard of it in other groups. I was beginning to experience people who were ex-members of various organizations who were involved in exit counseling. I met Pat Ryan at that point. I was invited to sit in on his sister's exit counseling while I was still involved with the Swami. He encouraged me to watch a video on hypnosis called Captive Minds. Yep. And I watched it, and it scared the hell out of me.
Yep.
Because it gave me another platform. It gave me a new way to experience and understand this reality, and caused me to be able to dive into alternative explanations. As I began to apply standards of measure, Robert Lifton standards, Margaret Singer's standards, and began to allow myself to credit my own experience with psychological realities as opposed to extraordinary spiritual realities, I began to believe that maybe there was something amiss, that what I had experienced was something that was quite manipulative. Yeah. And that the reasons I couldn't shake it were due to me being steeped in the environment, in the experience of meditation and chanting, that I had to see myself clear of it, that I began to experience such dissonance in my consciousness that I was panic stricken. And I had a house, but the Swami told me not to go back to that house in the TM village, that if I took a break, I should go somewhere else. that I could move out because the Swami had been threatened by someone who was my ally. And that person had actually gotten the goods on the Swami for arranging marriages and suggested that if the Swami gave me a graceful exit, that he would then, you know, not go forward with giving the government. It was blackmail to some extent, but he never really, you know, had to go through with it. The Swami came to me and out of the blue said to me, you should leave. And after he had told me that I should leave everything in my life and live in the ashram, he turned around and the message came to me, Joe, you can leave. So I was totally screwed at this point. I had no idea what was going on behind the scenes. I didn't know that he was feeling threatened because I thought he was invulnerable. Mm-hmm. That anyone who challenged his authority would certainly be, you know, a lightning bolt would hit them and they would be driven, you know, into hell, mm-hmm. or at least, you know, they would not succeed in their efforts to destroy the organization. Yet he was really threatened. Mm-hmm. And so in this process of, you know, being like a yo-yo, you know, going to live in the ashram, going back to live in my own home, knowing that I shouldn't go back there because I was still under the guru's influence. Yet I had this other way of looking at this stuff and I was teetering on the brink. I didn't know which way I was going to fall. I was encouraged to leave, to save the organization, to save the Swami from what might happen if I stayed. My friend and former business partner was driving me up to New York City where I was going to be involved in handing our business over to somebody who had said they would buy a portion of it. I was going to be training them on the sales of this product line that we were involved in. And I said to my friend, I said, I have to leave. I can't do this anymore. I feel ripped apart. I don't know where my faith lies. And my friend said, oh, Joe, please don't leave Swamiji. Don't do it. At that point, I almost began to feel the fresh air of freedom. Mm. A breeze started blowing through my mind that I could be free of this. Yeah. I could leave it behind. And yet I felt that no matter where I was, they would find me. It was, and I don't mean find me literally and hurt me in any way physically, but my psyche was split, that I was experiencing two worlds simultaneously. I was experiencing both the world of the group and the fact that I had to adhere to the guru's desire and still stay loyal and show myself to be a true soldier of the path. Yeah. And at the same time, that sense of freedom, that idea that there was something beyond the group, I had a way of looking at it. I had a body of knowledge. I had, you know, Dr. Lifton, Dr. Singer, you know, I had, what is mind control? Can I apply these themes to my own experience? And will they be able to guide me through the confusion that I'm feeling? Because truly that confusion was running my world at that point. Yeah. So I get to New York. I'm in this cavernous Jacob Javits Center, which was a place where they had a gift conference every year where people would sell their wares and people would come from shops and they would buy what they were buying for the season. I was handing the business over to this other who had been a competitor. We were going to make a little bit of money to pay my debts back at that point, The guru was encouraging me to stay loyal, but to leave. My friends were encouraging me to stay with the Swami and not even leave the ashram, that I was a turncoat, that I had virtually no money to my name. I was in big debt. So all of this was swimming around my brain. And it was there that I ran into the other partner, who happened to be Pat Ryan. And I said to him, I need to get out. I need to be free of this. And he was looking at me like, because we had been friends and he didn't trust me. And, you know, he had seen me come and go and be on this, you know, merry-go-round to go back and forth to the group. So was this for real? And he said, all right, you know, you can stay with me, but you know, you're going to have to take a look at your experience. And that was the first glimmer of freedom. That was the first hope I had that I could be separate from it. And I remember that first night thinking that I could be free of it and thinking that, you know, I certainly was going to die, that, you know, I wasn't going to be able to live much more in this life, or else I was going to become a drug addict. I was going to be, you know, fall back into my old patterns, that I was going to be miserable and unhappy. And none of it seemed to matter at that point. If all of that was my future lot, then I was going to take it.
Yeah.
I was going to take it. And then I you know, kind of asked, I came back to my house, and I began to tentatively step back into my old life. And it was, at first I moved into my parents' home, and then I moved into my own home. And my parents had no idea what was going on. They were totally confused. I showed up with this beat up old suitcase and a few items and said, oh, I'm moving back home. And they didn't know what to make of it. It was a very confusing time. So from there, I began to work in a company and for a company that inventoried supplies. I got some work, and I attended my first Cold Awareness Network conference in Seattle, Washington. And it was there that I began to meet exit counselors and began to talk to them and began to clear myself of some of the influences that had been ongoing. I know it's kind of dicey here, but it was there that I met a guy named Kevin Garvey. Yeah. And he was an exit counselor, and he listened to the story. He thought that it was compelling. He thought that I could be helpful. And I began to work with him. He became my mentor in the field. I don't know if you've heard, did you know Kevin?
No, I didn't.
No. He since passed away, and he was involved in really helping other people look at their involvement in large group awareness trainings. He had done a lot of research, went to Columbia, was quite an intellectual, and began to work with me and invite me to come on to cases and began to tell my story. And I began to be able to parse the story in ways that were meaningful to the people I was talking to. Yeah. So I began to learn the trade, if you will.
I think we came to a natural point where we can start talking about something else.
Right.
I did want to clarify what happened with the suit with TM.
So what we all settled out of court. Our attorney was offered settlements for the remaining eight of us, I believe, eight or nine of us. And we were able to settle out of court for, you know, an undisclosed, we're not allowed to say how much, but it wasn't an extraordinarily big settlement, but it was the money that I put into the movement. So I felt gratified that at least that money was returned. Mm-hmm. And that it was a way for me to be able to start back up again. Mm-hmm. Because the money came in, fortunately, just as I left group number two. So I had spent 14 and a half years in two different groups.
Yeah.
And so it was quite a bit of unsorting to do.
Okay, so we'll end this conversation. We'll have a little conversation after we stop the recording, if that's okay. I'm John Atack, and it's been a great privilege having Joe Kelly as my guest.
Thank you, John.
Hi, John here. Thanks for watching. We'd appreciate it very much if you would click like, as well as subscribe, and click the bell for notifications. Every dollar helps, and we welcome new patrons on Patreon, or you can make a one-off payment with any currency through PayPal. Thanks so much.